Committee, I welcome you with open arms.
Is that so? How late do you stay open?
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
I hope they are watching. They'll see. They'll see and they'll know. And they'll say, she wouldn't even harm a fly.
What's up, everybody? You're listening to NoCo Cinema here on WGN Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago. I am Tom Hush.
And I'm Connor Cornelius.
And we are so excited to be back with you for yet another fantastic week of Chicago film conversation. Actually, do you know what this is?
It's the 30th anniversary of Akira.
Yes.
That's actually true.
That is 100% true.
Yeah. Is that what you were going to say?
No.
Were you going to say what that an apple has been created genetically with an orange peel surrounding it, unbroken?
No.
Okay.
Damn
well,
it.
Now I have no guesses.
Listen,
what is
hey,
it?
This is a momentous occasion. The big 50.
50.
50
Wait
episodes.
A minute. No way.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Well, how do you denote that in Roman numerals?
Was it XL?
XL.
XL.
XL, baby.
I want to say that's, or no.
That's like 60, right? Or no, 40?
I don't know.
XL. L.
What was the last?
I think it's just L. I think you're right. It's just L.
Oh, it's super.
The big L.
The big L.
Yes.
Right on
All right.
the forehead.
Let's put,
we did it.
Let's put a Smash Mouth in there.
Yeah. Producer, can you please add a little Smash Mouth?
Yeah,
post?
Producers,
thank
no.
you.
We'll add it in post.
So yeah, welcome to the 50th episode of
wow.
NoCo Cinema. I can't believe we did it.
I'm so happy now.
I'm a little.
I was
surprised.
Cripplingly depressed this morning.
Yeah,
and now this has just turned it all around.
I'm so glad. I'm so glad. And we, you know, we wanted to celebrate our 50th episode, whether Connor knew it or not, by bringing back one of our favorite guests of the. Of the last year or so, over a year, we've been doing this, and now we're on episode 50. So we really wanted to talk about a project that I think is so exciting for the Chicago film community. I think it's really something that our guests, who I will introduce momentarily, they're really bringing together all of their skills, all of their hard work, and all of their goodwill here in the community to make something that's really special and really unique for the Chicago film community. Of course, I am talking about Black Sight the Musical from Soft Cage.
Yes, sir.
I
almost said ma'am.
I'm sorry. I can be whatever you want me to be. That is Black Sight the Musical, which tells an important story inspired by real events. So protesters came together to occupy a lot and build a community directly across the street from a secret interrogation facility run by the police department. The Black Site committed numerous illegal and horrific injustices and inspired a social justice abolitionist movement that still exists today. So this is an incredibly socially conscious film musical. I love that we're bringing musicals back, and we're going to do it the indie way. To talk about Black Site the Musical, we've brought in some of the folks behind it from Soft Cage. If you'd like to just introduce yourselves, we'll just go down the line.
I'm David A. Holcomb, director, editor, producer on the film.
I'm Spence A. Warren, producer on the film.
And I'm Adia Ivy. I'm one of the screenwriters for the film.
Well, so glad that you guys could join us today. We really appreciate it. I guess we just have to jump to the obvious. How did you guys come up with this idea of doing a musical, something that people generally attribute with, you know, bright, happy, dancing, you know, all that kind of tap. Do you guys have, is there any tap dancing?
Were you just referencing the dance. Gregory Hines, Savion Glover movie Tap?
Say yeah.
Like, was that what you were, was that what just happened right now? Because that would be amazing. Okay, never mind.
But it's
sorry
you know,
to disappoint.
Musicals are super, they're considered to be very bright, upbeat, all that kind of stuff. But we're mixing it with something that is very serious and something that people, you know, have been concerned about, should still be concerned about. You know, what made you decide to bring those two ideas together?
Well, I was following the news when the Black Site was exposed in The Guardian, and at the time we were making a lot of documentaries about social justice movements. We went to the Freedom Square, which inspired our story, And one of the first things I noticed about this encampment they had built is that they actually erected a stage. They had performances. They were using art in a radical way to protest and to create like a really stark juxtaposition. You know, across the street there were these atrocities occurring, and yet they were directly fighting it using things that were empowering. So that was really exciting. And like you said, I haven't really heard of any like super low budget indie musical films, and I knew this film would be dark, and I thought that the best way to approach this would be to make a rollicking musical about police brutality.
That's just previously unsaid sentences.
Right. Well, yeah. Musical about police brutality.
I imagine it opens up a little bit more room for dynamicism because you can approach it from like the. There can be moments of lightness and happiness, and instead of just directly making a movie where you're explaining, you know, maybe putting characters in being interrogated in the black site or whatever, right. It opens it up for a little bit more. You know, you can play with it a little bit more,
exactly,
and capture the empowerment. And we also have Adia Ivy here, who is a screenwriter.
Hey.
What was it like to work on writing that film?
I think when we were first discussing even that very topic, I feel like bringing music into it. Was a strategic way to not just make another film about suffering in a very one-dimensional idea and story, because there are so many aspects of it. And one thing I really liked about using the format of a musical is like the idea of frontality, of putting these emotions and thoughts that have been silenced for so long on the front line specifically for the audience. So I feel like incorporating that was a great part of the whole project.
And the person who composed the film, Angelo Natoli, did you work very closely with him while you guys were writing the film? Was
No, I met him later on, but like he's really great at what he does, and I was listening to some of his other work and it's great. But yeah, no, I was working more with the story itself.
Okay.
Not the music.
We've never interviewed anybody that's made a musical before, so I'm just curious about how you even go about starting to create one or creating one
and
from the ground.
None of us have ever made a musical before.
No one
so
that worked on this film had ever worked on a musical.
Not a single person, right. At least not a movie musical. That we've got a bunch of theater actors in this thing, so they've got stage musical experience, but not a single one of us has ever made a movie musical.
I don't think I've even met anyone that's made a musical movie.
I don't think I have either, actually. I do enjoy watching them, but this has been the first chance to make one. And so we're very much guiding ourselves by the same principles that we follow with any other project. Shore up the narrative as best we can. Make sure that we are engaging earnest, honest emotions where possible. Don't be afraid of the darkness or the light. I think that we actually, particularly in independent film, we have equal fear of both of those things. We fear the darkness. We also fear the light. We fear opportunities to be joyful and to show restraint, that kind of joyous restraint in things. So, you know, musicals allow you, as our folks were just saying, to elevate things in a way that no other form really does. So it was an exciting opportunity to test our metal in this way.
Were you guys afraid while you were making it that it was going to be too one-sided, either too fun, too light, and it would, you know, not really be doing the justice of the subject, or going too dark and you wouldn't really be doing the justice of the musical that they wanted to make?
I think I was more worried about doing the justice for the people. I think even when I was able to reach out to some people who actually experienced these instances, they articulated their own fear of just turning it into a spectacle. And so the biggest worry for me, the concern that I've been constantly, like, actively aware of, is just making sure that the truth is there and that there is genuine emotion and story behind it, not just spectacle.
So when it comes to researching these events, you mentioned that you spoke to some people. Like, how did you get yourself in the mindset of, I'm going to tell this story? What are the facts? What are the emotions behind it? What ways did you prepare to actually sit down and write this?
I think honestly, just having honest conversation. And I was just speaking to one of them on the phone, but it felt very natural. You know, it's not just asking questions blatantly, question after question. It's getting to know their life and how they got into that situation in the first place, how they found themselves at Holman Square. And I'm sorry. No,
It is one of those emotional things when you start getting into it. And when, as a writer, it's like, you know, it seems like you really have to dig deep. Those conversations you're talking about, and having to not just ask them questions, as you said, but get to know them as a person. There's a lot of empathy there. Did it get really difficult at times to hear those experiences?
No, absolutely. And there's so many levels to it that makes it so complex. And so making sure to capture all of these aspects in 30 minutes was a lot. And I think an important part of, like, even making this film is making obvious to the audience that there's always way more to the story, that the story goes beyond just these 30 minutes. You know, like, that organization still exists today and there's still injustices happening today. And I think overall, because our main goal was to start a conversation with the film, and that's what we want to be doing, because we haven't had this conversation in Chicago yet.
Right. A lot of people don't even know about it. I was telling people about what I was doing today, and they were like, what? People that have lived in Chicago or around it their entire lives. And yeah. I was doing a little bit of research on it before I came in today, and it's been around since the 90s.
Yeah.
And we didn't find out about it until, what, 2012 was when the Guardian article?
One of our locations was a hardware store. I don't know if I should mention which one, just, you know, to be on the safe side.
Oh, come on. Give them some promotion.
Oh, well, yes, that's true. But, I mean, well, you know what? Okay. PJ's Ace Hardware.
Okay.
Which is in Oak Park. They used to have a location, or the store used to be located in Holman, in Holman Square. And when we were describing to them the kind of movie that we were making and the story that we were telling in the negotiation to please, please let us come in and shoot this gear up sequence in your hardware store, you know, hat in hand kind of situation, he recounted to me a story. Not a story specifically, but just a memory of always knowing that something was going on in that old Sears building, and he could never quite put his finger on it, but it was very much a, we all knew that something was going on in there that was just not, wasn't right, is the way that he put it.
A lot of rumors of customers coming in and talking about it.
And, like, also seeing kind of cops coming in and out of there in ways that just rubbed him in a way that was uncomfortable. So it was interesting. There's like this hanging specter for people who are from that neighborhood of this complex of horrors. Mm-hmm.
And something that seemed very, you know, it's on the hush-hush. Mm. You know, you mentioned rumors, kind of just knowing. It's part of the narrative of the neighborhood. They're just like, yeah, that old Sears, something real fucked up is happening there.
Yeah.
But people are just kept away out of fear. And they don't want to know more. It's that darkness. You know, if you step too deep into it, I think that's maybe why that story didn't stick around as long, because they were just like, regular folks in the city read about it and they're like, oh shit, our police force is actively acting just out, completely out of jurisdiction, with impunity in our own neighborhood.
Someone described it to me as like a mini Guantanamo Bay in Chicago.
I mean, that's basically what it is.
Yeah.
It's just pure torture. And I guess that brings us to, you know, with making a film out of it, do you feel that there is, and with Soft Cage, I would say all of your films have a social, if not goal, but message, you know, you want to change something or at least flip the script, give a different perspective. With the very progressive, revolutionary at times, abolitionist undertones of this story, how do you think people, what do you want people to take away from watching Black Sight?
I'm really interested in this story mainly because it seems like the ways in which they were protesting was really creative and it was kind of like unassailable. You know, we're talking to the Let Us Breathe Collective, the people that founded the original Freedom Square, and just hearing them talk about how it changed the relationship between them as activists and the police that would come through and were not welcome in the camp. It was really interesting because there's nothing, you know, that the police could point to that would justify shutting it down. So they were able to grow and occupy this space and be safe and be sort of in their own little mini community that they had built themselves. It had its own rules without any interference. So I thought that was interesting because I think a lot of times when people take to the streets, there's a lot of tactics that the police use to undermine things like that. You know, whether it's having plainclothes cops start like physical altercations, and that justifies swooping in and shutting the whole thing down, things like that. This was so pure and so creative and such a obvious good for the community that there was no way that the police had any. I mean, they were just kind of impotent. They couldn't do anything in the face of this thing. And it brought so much attention to it. It empowered so many people. And it's the kind of thing that still exists and only grew after they left that site. They moved into a building. They still exist. They're still working towards social justice. And so the other part of this film is we're going to put a little documentary at the end about the real story. Mm-hmm. The real events all the way up to present day, and to try to have a call to action so that people can actually get involved. Like, if this upsets you, there's something you can do about it. Mm-hmm. We don't have to feel powerless.
Did making the film sort of feel like that? It was something that once you told people about it, I mean, it does seem like it, at first glance, it kind of seems like it could be a hard sell, right? But when you think about it a little bit more deeply, like, film is a compelling medium to tell a revolutionary story, and so is music. And both of those things are proven out in history, or, you know, historically. So when you brought this to Spence and you brought this to the people at Soft Cage, and you started getting the writers like Adia Ivy and Ajani Moulton, and getting the casting director together and all that, were people really excited about it, or did some people try to distance themselves a little bit from it?
I'm actually having a hard time thinking of anyone that, like, was turned off by the idea. I think that the exciting part was that, like, first thing that I thought of over 2 years ago was sort of this, like, little elevator pitch. And it was so fun to see how I could just, like, throw out this two-line pitch to people, and they'd be like, whoa, I've never heard of anything like that. Like, we kept hearing that over and over again. Like, I don't think film has to reinvent the wheel every time. I don't think you need to have, like, this awesome idea that you protect and it's going to just be revolutionary. But this was the first time I feel like that just kind of happened. Like, I'm pitching it to people and they're like, whoa.
Yeah.
Like, when you start making the film, contact me, or I can hook you up with this person. And, like, suddenly the ball started rolling, and it was like the momentum was kind of out of our hands. Like, I had, like, a list of dream musicians that I'll reach out to, but there's no way. Like, they're way out of our league. And they worked on the film. Like, the legendary Ono, a band from the 70s in Chicago, one of the first punk rock bands in the first wave. And they became this, like, noise avant-garde band that's still around. And they're incredible. And they have this rich history. And like I said, they're legends. And I've never thought in a million years that they would be interested, but they sat down with us for interviews. They worked on some songs in the soundtrack. They're helping promote us now. I mean, it was incredible.
They not only referred to our movie as important on their social media, which, shout out Ono Band, thank you. They also, the session for recording music with them was very different than it was with every other musician. How? Because they invited us, the five of us, so our music director, Patrick Burke, our composer, Angelo, David, our director, and myself.
And Matt Frost,
our sound mixer, and also Angelo's girlfriend. She was invited to come down. So we all come down there. I think I did the math wrong, 6 of us. So we all come down there to their house on the south side where Travis, lead singer for Ono, cooked us a meal, demanded that we eat as much of it as humanly possible, and then talked with us about how the band started, and then the rest of the band came in and they also ate food. So effectively what they invited us into was their regular Sunday tradition of feeding each other, talking about stuff, and then playing music, which they did. They then proceeded to have a full rehearsal with costumes. Nice. In their living room.
Do they wear costumes when they play?
The lead singer, Travis, he goes through multiple costume changes. And he did it in the
rehearsal.
Every
single one of those costume changes happened in the rehearsal. It was
They were prepping to go on a big tour, so they were going through their set. And they like to make every single set on their tour completely different, like a unique show.
So they made us food, and then they made incredible art in front of us, and then they said, so what would you like us to do?
After they did all that.
Yeah. What would you like us to do? Like, what kinds of beats would you like us to hit? Like, we thought we were going to go in there, and they were just going to kind of, like, crank something out real quick and hand it to us. Instead, they, like, asked us specifically for, like, the beats that they want to hit and, like, the style that we needed and all sorts of stuff. We were able to kind of craft it.
Travis was able to assume sort of like a character within the film, you know, not having seen the film. We haven't shot the scene yet, but just, you know, working with him, talking about, like, if you're a vocalist and you're going to be part of this, if your voice is part of this scene, who are you? And so there's things that are in that scene that I can't imagine that scene without it, but I couldn't have imagined it ahead of time either.
No. And now the Black Site itself has a voice.
Yeah.
It is itself a character with a voice, which is great.
And it's singing.
And it's, well...
Well...
It's not exactly singing... it's Travis-Travising.
Right. Check out Ono. You'll see what we're talking about.
Yeah, I need to now.
I have a feeling that he would prefer that we refer to it that way. He's Travis-Travising.
Yeah.
And he Travis-Travises like no one else has ever Travis-Travised before.
He's like the freest artist I've ever met in my life.
Pretty incredible.
It's inspiring. I mean, he's like something like 72 years old, I believe, and he's more vital than 20-year-olds I know. It's incredibly inspiring to see someone
who's definitely in better shape
like
than
in
any
his
of us
peak right now. Yeah. You know? Yeah, exactly.
What was that Akira Kurosawa quote where he said that he believes that the real work doesn't begin until after you're 80?
Yeah.
That guy didn't. Travis traversing expectation. Yeah.
Yes.
He's growing up so Travis fast.
A Kurosawan level of dedication.
Yeah.
Can't wait to see what he does in the next 10 years.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I want to jump into some of the nuts and bolts of getting people together and getting them all to perform like choreographed sequences to music that, you know, if we've seen some of the footage, and it just looks incredible.
Cool.
Like, we've seen stills, it looks unbelievable. And so I wanted to talk to you guys about, where did you find some of the performers? How did you get together and find some of the locations where you shot? How did that all come together?
Piece by piece.
Yeah, yes. You know, I mean, like, some of them we found through just our network of friends. Some of them we found just through auditions, and we got just weird and lucky.
Some stuff, like, just one quick little story about, like, one of our... So we had our composer, Angela, who was sort of, like, the mastermind. But for each song, we collaborated with songwriters. And we also, on top of that, had several lyricists, and some of the lyricists would write verses for across multiple songs, perhaps tracking like a particular relationship through that arc in the film, so that there was like a consistent voice that you can kind of track through the film. One of those lyricists, Fury,
MC Fury, shout out
MC Fury. I heard an interview with her on the radio, and it was one of those weird moments where, like, I didn't know this was before the script was even written, but I kind of knew we were making this film, and I was just kind of trying to be aware of different voices that might be interesting to try to pull in. And I heard this interview with her, and I pulled over my car, and I like wrote her name down. And then a few months later, I was working this street festival, and it's like this country rock festival, and all of a sudden I hear like hip hop and rhyming, and I'm like, what is this? And I walk around to the edge of the stage, and I see that it's Fury. And so, of course, I like ran over to her as soon as her set was done, and I'm like, this is really bizarre, because I have this film that I really want to get you involved in. And immediately she was into it. And so that kind of thing was like, oh, like my dream choice. And now I'm like standing here in a room talking with you, and we're like collaborating.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's crazy. And that happened...
And purely by happenstance.
That's like one detail.
Purely by happenstance.
And that happened like 1,000 times in this film, where we're just like, for real?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there are a lot of moments where where things kind of fell into our laps, you know, with a couple of the locations, with some of the artists. But I think that, you know, we were so ready once the artists came to us that all we had to do was tell them what we were doing. Yeah. And I think that there's we spent hours preparing in writing sessions, hours preparing in just like crafting not only the script, but talking about the characters, talking about what kind of design we want the film to have, talking about just, you know, I have this thing that David's heard me say a zillion times, bringing sort of big budget principles and values to low budget filmmaking, because not all of them cost money. Some big budget practices and habits are just practices and habits. One of them is talking incessantly about details of your story and of the film that you're trying to make out of your story. Mm-hmm. And in
creating
so
a common
doing,
language too is really
we create
key.
A common language and we create the necessary material so that we can go out and say that we're making a rollicking musical about police brutality in Chicago, you know?
Didn't know what we're talking about.
And people can go, whoa. And when they engage us with that, because the woe is like, that's the first part. But the important part is after the woe, and they say, tell me about it.
Exactly.
You know, and do we have enough material to fill? Do we have enough? Do we have the idea distilled down enough where we could tell you about it on an elevator from one floor to the next? Answer is yes. We've got that part. Do we also have enough space to fill like a 5 or 10 minute conversation? Perhaps we have enough to fill a podcast episode, you know.
Bringing it full circle.
And once we have that.
Wait, we're out here now.
Yeah.
It just got meta.
Welcome.
Yeah. Adia, maybe you can shine a light on something I was curious about. How many drafts did the script need to go through? How many rewrites and all that? I mean, there it is.
Yeah.
She's like, oh, man, a million.
The answer is breaking out into laughter.
One and done.
I feel like I can at least say 5 throughout the year, I would say. Yeah, it's grown a lot. And it was also just like a great experience because it was my first time like officially screenwriting. I've written scripts before, but this was, I guess, the most technically formatted and like down to every single detail kind of thing. But yeah, it developed a lot from the first draft to final.
What were some of the biggest changes that you had to make? Was it like character wise or location or just the structure of the story?
I would probably say the character development, because again, when we were first writing it, it was going beyond 30 minutes and we just have to cut it down enough. While still making sure that they're actual characters with personalities and problems. So I think that was probably the most challenging, but also making sure that the writing's consistent amongst the three writers of us, just because we have slightly different styles. But yeah, and I feel like, because David mentioned like common communication, and like also incessantly talking about the production throughout the entire process. Mm-hmm. And I feel like being able to have the same vocabulary definitely helps make sure that we're all on the same level and the same understanding of how we want the characters to be, how we want the story to be, and everything like that.
I mean, that's the most difficult thing to do is nailing characters in 30 minutes while still having the rollicking musical going on.
Man, yeah. Features are easy.
Yeah, features. That's nothing compared to a 30-minute... 30-minute bad boy.
The whole film is going to be 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And was there a specific reason that you wanted to do that? Did you feel as though that working
budget reasons,
that time
for, union rules, there's a whole slew of reasons.
Okay. Well, we don't have to go into that one. But I was curious because I wasn't actually sure. I was going to ask, like, what is the, for people who are interested in, you know, donating to the movie and helping make it become a reality, like, what can we, like, expect from what the film is going to look like? You know what I mean?
But, I see.
That's, so 30 minutes is going to be the whole runtime plus the little documentary that you mentioned.
I would
at the
say
end.
That it is a traditional three-act structure, and there are characters that have big arcs, and there are relationships that develop and change, and there are just the amount of ground we cover in that 30 minutes could easily be a feature film. Like, this is one thing about the process of writing the script is that everything kind of was coming together all at once. So the script was, like, in its final, you know, they had sort of broken up the workload and were, like, putting together, you know, radically reimagining sort of, like, the structure of the screenplay while we're writing music, while I'm locking down locations. So it was important that, like, everyone knew exactly what story we're telling so that we could all be kind of putting everything into place all at once. And the benefit of that was that every single moment in the film, I was just talking to Spence about this. This has never been my experience on a film. It's so tight and rich that, like, every moment of action builds on character, forwards the plot, and contributes to the theme. So every moment is full. There's not any just sort of, like, Terrence Malicking going on.
There's a way you don't have any, you know, shots of wheat. Like, oh, wow.
Or
the fragility of life.
Well, in wheat at that point. Yeah. Right.
So I would say it's a 30-minute film, but it won't feel smaller than a feature film.
Well, and I think that has to do with a lot of the fact that it's a musical.
Yeah.
And one thing I've always noticed with musicals, both on the stage and the screen, is that the song, a good musical, the music does work. It does work for you. So you've got the script there.
It is a scene.
Yeah, it's got a lot of dense stuff in the script, and then you have to work on the music too, which also has to be in tandem with that script. As you mentioned, the layers of character, theme, plot, all that kind of stuff.
So, David and I were talking about... Sorry to cut you off.
No, you're good.
David and I were talking about, like, action sequences as they relate to sex scenes, as they relate to songs in musicals or movies or whatever, you know, the things that use those materials as their building blocks, and what those three things have in common is that when done properly, and in this context by properly I mean done in a way that is motivated to tell story, expose character, and forward plot, preferably all at the same time. Mm-hmm. When those things do that, they're sublime and they're remembered, and they become the big set pieces. And when they're done poorly, they're the thing that you point to when you're laughing at the movie and talking about how bad it was. So
it's either exploitative or, like, you can have a fight scene that feels like porn.
Yeah.
Or, like, in Game of Thrones, the where we get the term sexposition.
Yeah.
Sexposition. It's like, I'm going to explain what's happening right here, but also naked.
A
but
sex scene naked. That feels like an action scene or an action scene that feels like porn.
Exactly. You know, I mean, and the difference is really interesting. When you take something like Game of Thrones and you compare it to Spartacus, Blood and Sand, for instance, and you get a pretty broad difference, despite the fact that both of those things show very explicit sexuality, but in one, it informs character, and another, it kind of like a music video. You know, it's a digression. So, you know, not that all music videos are digressions, to be clear, but to add to the answer to your question of what you can expect, we all tried our damnedest to craft a narrative that was full of like truth, you know, and we tried our damnedest to do that in a way that's engaging and hopefully entertaining and hopefully provides some kind of an intellectual challenge. And I think that that stuff came through on the screen. I think that the actors felt that and brought it to their performances. I think that the musicians felt that and brought it to the songs that they wrote and the things that they played. I think that we managed to express our controlling idea with all of the aspects, like at the fundamental level.
Mm-hmm. Wow. What would you say to someone who sees this or hears about this musical and they say, this is anti-police, or this is propaganda? Oh, well. Ooh, what would you say to someone? This is, you know, this is bad. Essentially, someone who says this is unfair to police, this is unfair to law-abiding citizens, this is just what's the word? Liberal bullshit. I don't know what to, like. Sure. Obviously, this is a strong
stuff.
Yeah. Obviously, this is
Kennedy's
is a strong
feminazi agenda.
People that are afraid. People that are afraid of hearing something like that, right? Yeah. Because it's overly challenging.
I mean, that's why it was such a huge responsibility to tell this story, and so we started with the research. I mean, we were there. I was there, and I filmed footage, and I talked to people while it was happening. We reached out to we tracked down every lead. We had a full-time researcher during the writing phase of the script on staff, and Adia reached out to many survivors, and we did, of course, attempt to talk to police. We were able to talk to some police that weren't necessarily Chicago police, but just kind of talking about procedures and things like that. But I think that the story that we're telling, while it is an elevated form, the musical, it's all grounded in humanity and reality and things that actually happened. So you can't really come at us in terms of like the experiences that people had.
Because you all did your homework, essentially.
So this happened, and that's provable, you know? Yeah. So you can't really come at us with that. So if it feels anti-police, well, then maybe there's some things that need to change with the police, or maybe policing always inevitably leads to this.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
it's like the most over-policed neighborhood in all of Chicago. Like, Holman Square, the actual black site, talking to Let Us Breathe Collective, and just hearing about, like, two or three blocks that way, there's a huge police station. Two or three blocks in the other direction, there's a police station. It's just, like, a police state that they live in constantly. And then the black site on top of that. So, more and more and more police, this is what happens.
Yes. And people just don't know about it, either. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't. Yes. In the city.
Yeah.
To all of our fellow postmodern neo-Marxist feminazi libtard SJWs out there.
Shout out Jordan Peterson.
I just have to say that when you're telling stories about the establishment, it's the really easy thing to do, and we talked about this a ton as we were crafting the thing. The really easy thing to do is to reduce the forces of antagonism to cliches, particularly when those forces of antagonism are some form of the establishment. Mm-hmm. I think that what we tried to do, and I think we accomplished it, we set out to make our cops characters. They're people. They're people who made choices that we would think of as terrible choices, but they're people. They have dimension. And so to anyone who would suggest that this is an anti-police story, the first thing that I would say is that it happened. that this is we have changed bits and pieces here and there in our narrative. We've crafted our own story from the events, but the events did happen. So we're not making up that. The second thing that I would probably say is that if you are a member of law enforcement, you should be for communities doing what our film is suggesting that communities do, which is coming together, supporting each other against whatever form of oppression there is, and you should be standing with them in that. You should not be standing, you should not be the thing that they're fighting. You should be the thing standing next to them fighting whatever the thing is. So yeah, I guess
it's literally emblazoned on the sides of their cars, right?
Yeah, that serve and protect. Yeah, right. So that's the service and that's the protection. And once we lose that, then we've lost a lot. Some would say that it was never there in the first place. So we have to figure out where we go from there and come at the problem, in this case being the way that we police in megalopolises like Chicago, and particularly in smaller neighborhoods, predominantly people of color neighborhoods like Homan Square, and come at that honestly. If you believe that the key to making neighborhoods safe is to crack down as hard as you can and squeeze the life out of as many people as possible so that you can keep them in line, then just say that and be clear about that. I will disagree with you, but then we can have a dialogue, like an actual honest dialogue, and maybe even come to some kind of a conclusion, you know, as other people enter that dialogue and decide how they feel, you know. And I earnestly believe that most people, I honestly believe that most people don't feel that way. It is my earnest belief that most folks would say, well, that don't sound right.
Is this an optimistic film? Do you feel that this ends on a note of hope?
I would say it's hopeful. I don't know if I would say it's optimistic. You know, you feel me?
How
on
do
that?
You differentiate the two?
I think optimism lives in a kind of belief that the nature of everything is good and sunshine and rainbows and lollipops are, in fact, what the world is made of. Whereas hopefulness is about believing that things can be better than they were before and can, in fact, continue to get better than they've ever been. And I think that a cursory look at history proves that that has been so.
I agree with, I like the definition that you just put out there for hopeful. And I do feel like with the way that we provide our ending, it's putting out there that there are solutions there. They're tangible. Change can happen. It's just a matter of going for it. And obviously it's not just like, oh, we'll just get it done. Everything's fixed. Right. It's a process because it's a systemic issue. But I guess just because we talk about the different ways we can approach activism, and I feel like it's very easy to feel hopeless. And so providing the different ways that we can make a change is what the overall message of the film is about. And that if people walk away from watching that, seeing it just as a liberal agenda or fuck the police, then I feel like that is a very fundamental issue in itself, because the main thing is to start a discussion about it in the first place.
All right. I want to end it with one last question. And this is for everybody. Feel free to take turns. What's your favorite musical?
Oh,
yeah. There we go.
There we go.
We're expecting that. Were you?
No. What is?
I know Spencer's.
And it can be. It can be Disney.
Dave's.
It could be Disney. It could be Okay. Anything you've seen. It could be musical adjacent. It doesn't have to be strictly classical thinking musical, but just to end on the fact that this is a musical, I want to know.
I'll start and I'll do Spence's.
Oh, all right.
Spence's favorite musical, Jesus Christ Superstar.
It very much is. Musical. I saw it in high school. So we're going to do this backwards. You're going to then say it. So I saw it in high school. My music teacher, Phyllis Cartwright is her name. I don't know where she is in the world. I haven't spoken to her since I was in high school. So there you go. But she had a very profound influence on me, and she was doing this unit where she was talking about opera, and she started by saying that opera is like basketball, and we were all like, tell us more.
So you've got the small forward.
You've got a center, and they need to be aggressive in the blocks. See, here's the right. You need to have a presence in the paint. No, opera is like basketball in this way, that she continued. It's boring if you don't know the rules. And it was like, oh. Knowing the rules of a thing is what makes it interesting. And little did I realize that would be like a part of my entry into story itself, and like learning how to tell it and how that works, sports and story, that we could do a whole podcast about that. Point is,
we will.
She showed us Jesus Christ Superstar after we had learned some of the rules of opera, and I had never spent that much time with rock and roll before, and it was just like, oh my God, this is everything that I've ever hoped for from this thing that I used to hear about called musicals. Mm-hmm. So I revisited a lot. I just saw it at the Lyric. It was unbelievable. We won't talk about the TV show thing.
Yeah, I was going to ask.
Yeah.
I mean, whole other podcast. Come on, John.
Yeah. Stuff. Like we said, we're producing it now.
That. Oh, God.
It's all in pre-production.
David's favorite musical is Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
I've never even heard of that one.
Are you serious? Oh.
No, I haven't.
That is a very punk rock musical.
No, you get great. You have an opportunity now.
Yeah.
Wow, teachable moment.
Tell me. Yes. We'll insert the graphics later.
Yeah. I was working at a theater in high school. And I was an usher, and as an usher, you kind of duck in and out of the theater all day long. And so you see movies across when they're released. You see them in like 5 minute chunks, 10 or 25 minute chunks throughout the day for like 3 weeks. And sure. So seeing that film was even out of order like that. Like I saw pieces of it, and every time I walk in, I'm like, okay, is this the same movie? Like, what is happening? It's everything. It's so dark. It's so joyful. It's so punk rock. It explores, transgender issues. It explores East and West Berlin during the Cold War. It explores fame and depression and just so much cool stuff. And the way it does it is so like DIY. Like it felt like this is something you could make, because there's like hand drawn animations that pop up. There's like, Just everything about it was something I'd never seen before. It was completely disorienting and kind of introduced me to one of the films that introduced me to filmmaking as an art rather than like a big budget entertainment sort of, grindhouse situation.
Sure. And what's it called? It's Hedwig and the...
Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
The Angry Inch. Okay.
Yeah. I only just saw it a couple of months ago, actually.
Oh. Isn't it great?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was good.
Oh, right. That's all I got. Just still Hedwig?
Oh, yeah. No, I saw it a couple months ago. I think my favorite is probably Chicago, though. I saw it when I was like 12 and... Yeah, and I saw it again for Humanities because we were talking about like morality, and we're like, let's dive into it. And yeah, I don't know. It made me appreciate it more. But I didn't realize, because I didn't grow up seeing much like live musicals, mm-hmm. and I didn't realize the like... major difference between a film musical and like actually seeing it live, like how they can be different but also what can be added through film. Mm-hmm. So I think it was nice to reference while working on this project.
Yeah, and that's the Richard Gere Chicago the musical.
Yeah.
That's a good Richard Gere.
Good Zellweger. Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Yes. She dips beneath lasers. Oh.
Wait, is that an actual song?
It's from a show, right?
I'm not sure. Yeah.
Workaholics.
Ah, yes.
When they sing about Catherine Zeta-Jones in Entrapment with Sean Connery.
Yeah, Sean Connery.
All right.
Everyone do your best Sean Connery. Go.
Go fuck yourself, Blofeld.
All right. Black Sight, the musical, an incredibly thoughtful exploration of a very serious topic with dance numbers and everything you could ever want out of a musical.
Should we it's going to be the Indiegogo?
Yeah, please. Where
we have an Indiegogo, y'all. It's going to be up in 2 weeks. We're raising money to finish this thing.
All right.
If you like social justice and music and hip-hop and stuff, you should give us some money and we'll give you some of that.
And if you want to see more radical, risk-taking films like this in Chicago.
Yes, Soft Cage Films, who you guys have been making films like this for a long time now, and we really appreciate you guys. I mean, really, if you want to see some truly thoughtful filmmaking, some of the most intelligent filmmaking by some of the most intelligent people in the filmmaking community, I mean, seriously, fantastic. Where can we follow Soft Cage on social media, and what's the name of the Indiegogo for Black Sight?
Well, if you search Black Sight the Musical on Indiegogo, you'll find it. Otherwise, we do have a link to it on the front page of our website, softcagefilms.com. We're on Instagram now, the kids tell me.
The kids!
We're on Facebook, Soft Cage Films. The Instagram, I believe, is Black Sight the Musical. There's some hashtags in there, too. Mm-hmm.
There's a couple Tutrianos.
Yeah, if you're into that.
If you're Chicagoan. And we have to give shouts out, because one of the other things that we must do is give attention to these folks. Let Us Breathe Collective. Check them out, because they're still here. Mm-hmm. They are one of the major inspirations for this story, and they are doing incredible work. LetUsBreatheCollective.com. Go there and find out how social justice can be fun.
And they have open houses. The Breathing Room series is weekly, so you just show up and get
poetry,
involved, hang out,
and music, and guided meditations, and art, and a free store. That's exactly what it
sounds
like.
And some of the most inspiring conflict resolution I've ever seen in my life.
Oh, man.
All right, David Holcomb, Spence, Warren, and Adia Ivy, all from Soft Cage. Thank you so much for coming on
the
show.
Thanks for having us again, y'all.
Spectacular conversation.
We're really excited to see this. It's
cool.
It's going to be special. We can tell.
In 6 to 8 short months.
only 20 million seconds until the release.
Yeah. Thank you so much for listening to this 50th episode of Noco Cinema. I can't believe we did it. Thank you so much for being with us for all 50 episodes. Let's hope for 50 more.
Oh, yeah. Well, we did get that coveted 100-episode order. I sent it to you.
But. Oh, yeah. You sent me, hey, can we do another 50 episodes, please?
I was begging
you. Sure, why not?
Just now, I did.
Oh, boy. Again, you guys are amazing. This has been Noco Cinema here on WGN Plus. We're your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago. I am Tom Hush.
And I'm Connor Cornelius.
And we will see you all next week.